Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signa Darpinian, co-author of No Way and Raising Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. Today, we are going to focus on the signs of healthy love in midlife and beyond. We'll talk about some tips for improving communication and bringing vitality into long-term relationships, and address topics like empty nest, as well as the nuances of dating at this stage of life. Joining us for this conversation is Dr. Brenda Schaefer. Dr. Schaefer is the best-selling author of Is It Love or Is It Addiction? With over 600,000 publications sold in 12 languages. She is a licensed psychologist, certified addiction specialist, and holds a doctorate in spiritual psychology. Dr. Schaefer is a national and international lecturer and workshop presenter. Welcome to the show, Dr. Brenda.
Thank you.
So, Brenda, the signs of a healthy relationship that I talked about in the intro are the opposite of the love and romance addiction we've covered in episode 7 and episodes 11. And I thought a good starting place might be talking about some of the signs of healthy love.
Great. I think that the important thing is that love and relationships are really separate entities. We know that we can be in a relationship and that are toxic and mean, and there's more fear than there is love. And I think the first thing I want to say is that I believe love is a choice. We have that ability. It is something that we get to feel and exchange and express. You know, starting there, what is love? You know, what does it look like in a relationship? Because it's our responsibility to take that energy and put it in the relationship. And I don't think people understand, certainly in addictive love, they are looking for love, you know, they're saying, in all the wrong places. And they experience love when they're maybe in a romantic relationship, or someone is loving them or giving them affirmations. But in healthy relationships, whether people are aware of it or not, they choose certain behaviors, certain emotions, certain thoughts that they bring to that relationship that are more from the love experience.
I'm thinking of some of the signs of healthy love. Can you give an example?
Yeah. You know, I say that a healthy relationship is green and growing. And what does that mean? I'll give you a few of the highlights. I mean, I talk about 20 characteristics, and there are more, but some of the important ones in a healthy relationship, first of all, there's a feeling of safety. It's safe to be me. It's safe to have feelings. It's safe to have needs. It's safe to disagree. It's safe to be successful. And that generates this sense of peace and relaxation that actually is we experience physically. Like in an addictive relationship, we're often very tense. We're wondering, what is that person thinking about us? Or does he love me? Do I love him? Or we're walking on eggshells. Or we're trying to figure out, what is that person thinking about me? What does that person need from me? And I think that, and I've said this in the other interviews, that I think addictive love can contribute to sickness. And healthy love, really, I mean, we know there's a lot of research that healthy love actually generates health, well-being. It can decrease a depression. So love is real, and the benefits of love are real. The other characteristic that's really important is that there's a high level of trust. And what does that mean? You know, it means we believe those people or a person accepts us unconditionally. They don't always like what we do or say, but we know that they're there. And the second characteristic is reliability. You can count on them. You know, if you were across the ocean and you needed them, they would come. And another one that's really important is congruence. And what does that mean? The words and the actions match. So if a person is saying, I love you, and the next words are put downs, they don't match. Or I love you, but I'm not going to give up drinking. That's incongruent. Mm-hmm. So that's very prevalent in unhealthy relationships. So in healthy love, in order to trust someone, their words and their actions need to match. And if they don't, that person will come to you and say, you know what? I don't like the way I just talked to you. You didn't deserve that, and I'm better than that. And I think that that then puts the whole relationship into integrity. I think another characteristic is that a healthy relationship allows for oneness and separateness. You know, I talk about in every relationship, there's a I, a you, and a we. And that I, the we can only be as healthy as the I and the you. So there's, I think you know this, that we use the word enmeshment, I use love addiction, we use the word codependency, but in an unhealthy relationship, there is that unhealthy enmeshment, and we are compromising ourselves to be or stay in a relationship with another, or they're compromising themselves to be with us. So I could go on. I think another one is that in a healthy relationship, there are healthy boundaries. And we are proactive rather than reactive. You know, in most unhealthy relationships or immature relationships or love addiction, people are quick to react. They don't stop and listen and think about what the other person is saying. So having healthy boundaries is maybe something like, I need to think about what you just said. I'll get back to you. Rather than defending, blaming, shaming, which are aspects of addictive love. Another one that is really hard for people in terms of healthy boundaries is knowing your bottom line or knowing your limits and being able to say, whoa, you know, that's not okay. And not personalizing what others say or do. That's a hard one, because when people criticize us, even though we may think it's not valid, we will become defensive rather than saying to ourselves, that's not who I am, and say it silently and not take in the criticism. I think another one is that a healthy relationship, any time of life, brings out the best qualities in us.
Yeah.
And there's a sense, like I said earlier, there's a sense of peacefulness when we feel safe, when we trust, when we're our own person, and that's not a threat to someone, then we naturally grow. It's green and growing.
It's interesting. In preparing for today's interview, I've been talking to everybody that I know and just kind of asking them some questions. You know, it's like, what would you want to know about a long-term relationship? Mm-hmm. And one thing that I have found kind of interesting is that people are really willing to talk about it. They want to talk about what's going on and what they're concerned about. So What are some themes that you see the most often in a long-term relationship?
Wow. That's a huge question. But I think of obviously the people that come to me are usually in crisis. And there's a lot of blaming and shaming of the other person. And I think that those who, you know, do the work, and you know what work is, you know, they really take the time to know themselves and take a look at, well, what do I bring in a relationship? Why do I have temper tantrums? Or, you know, why do I say and do the things I do? And so I think a lot of times when couples come in, they come in crisis and they don't have tools to get out. First of all, they don't know themselves well enough to understand that most of who they are is unconscious, and that there are reasons that they might get triggered by a certain word or a certain even gesture of their partner. So I think that for me, then I usually take time to get to know the people or help them get to know themselves. But you asked about what are the themes. The themes I see is there's some kind of crisis and they don't know what to do with that crisis except blame the other person and things, or stop talking to each other, stop communicating, getting involved in something else. And, you know, that's in crisis situations. But I think in general, I have some couples who have come to me that really aren't in crisis, but they don't know how to grow beyond where they are. Maybe their children left for college and now they're alone and they have these habits and they're a little bored with each other. And it's been really great to see some of these couples who really want to grow and improve their communication or show more affection or share more with their partner. Because I think what happens is, you know, most people start out in a high in a relationship and we know how the brain works. You might be sexually attracted to someone, then you fall in love. And then you have to shift to that bonding chemical, you know, become friends and grow together. I think a lot of people have trouble with emotional intimacy and doing the bonding. But I think that people then may have children, they have jobs. If they don't have children, they have careers, and they go on with life until the children leave the nest, so to speak. Or they retire, or a lot of people are retiring early. And what do you do now with a love relationship? I mean, this is actually a time where you can really get to know each other as well as yourself. And I don't think people planned for that phase of life when the job isn't as important or the children are gone. What is their vision of their future? Maybe one person has a vision and has never shared it with the other, and the other person has an entirely different vision. So I think that couples need to stay connected. You know, they need to make time for each other that's specific to the relationship from day one, and to be able to grow in that relationship as they're growing as parents or in their profession. And those people will make it, you know, and they'll say, great, now we have time to do more of what we enjoy with each other.
What's an example of how you would even start to improve communication? Like, what would the first step be?
Well, the first step is kind of observing how they communicate, and usually it's by pointing the finger at the other person and blaming them for their unhappiness. And it's like, if you would just tell him to do this, everything will be okay. Or if she would just stop this addiction, everything would be okay. So somehow stepping back out of that, being a judge and a referee, you know, it's getting to look at their patterns and somehow asking them to take a look at those patterns and learn to, instead of the blaming and the shaming and the guilting and the crying or whatever it is, to be able to have develop more skills of compassion and to understand that everyone, I mean, this is what I believe, that our dysfunction really comes, has a source somewhere. You know, why are you so sensitive to when she does this or say this? And there's, and bring that out. And to have the partner develop some compassion to see where that is coming from.
So compassion for self or compassion for the partner's behavior?
For the partner's behavior.
Okay, so say for example, I don't know, let's play on stereotypes here, I guess. Let's say the woman is in session with you and she says, if he would just do some load sharing, then we would be all right. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm doing more than everybody else around here. I'm working harder than he is at this relationship and in this home. What might you say to her?
I might say, why do you think that's his pattern?
And let's pretend I'm her. And she'd say, well, because, you know, he's lazy after he gets home from work and I work too. He just thinks it's time to relax. And to me, it feels lazy and selfish.
I hear that. But do you know anything about his background? What was his dad-mother's relationship like?
He was raised in a traditional way. His mom stayed home. His dad was at work. And her job was more of the household and rearing children.
So I might point that out, but I'd also find out, how do you ask for help? And
well, I say, as an example, there's this bowl sitting by the couch, which was his dinner. And when I got up and he got up, I said, like, are you going to leave that there?
And what did he do?
He said, no, I'm going to get it. That's what he says every night. And each night it's left out.
So then you have to ask, when are you going to get it into the dishwasher?
Okay. Not are you, when are you?
Yeah. When are you? But also maybe, you know, having a discussion to say, you know, I know you're tired and can we discuss this topic because I'm tired too. And can we agree what you will do and what I will do, you know, rather than because I need help, to come with those I statements.
Okay.
Rather than, I think what happens in relationships, people collect bad feelings. And so they build up so they can justify an explosion or a yelling at or shifting to a victim position, like, you never help me, you know. So I think that, you know, if you point out that, you know, a relationship is like a 100-piece puzzle. You were lucky to get 10, 20, 30 of those pieces, and most of those were dysfunctional. You can learn how to share. You can learn how to change patterns. You can have better communication. But it has to start with both people wanting it. And I mean, sometimes it's just reading a book or listening to a blog, you know, and say, oh, yeah, there is another way. And I believe that most people want to grow. You know, we have these two polar opposites, you know, the resistance to change and the desire to keep growing. And I think so many people fear that if they don't have the answer, that there's something wrong with them, rather than let them know, hey, you know, learning and growing is a positive characteristic. You know, that's also a sign of healthy belonging. You know, the willingness to change, the being vulnerable. And I think that those inner core beliefs that people have that they keep replaying in their heads are what get people in trouble. And I think in couples counseling, you have to somehow flush that out.
Back to the woman talking about the dish being left out. Would this be an example where you say, well, how does it make you feel that he leaves it out? Well, it makes me feel like I don't matter. And then you might, you might hang out there and get a little bit more information about, are there other times that you felt like you don't matter? Is that an example of an inside job? So if you work on knowing that you matter, that will get activated less. Is that the idea?
Exactly. That, that this situation, probably this feeling of I don't matter or I'm not important, I'm not worth loving, that goes back to childhood. And I think that, you know, as I talked about in love addiction, we are unconsciously wanting our partners to fix that brokenness inside of us. And they can't. It's not their job. Or even if they say you are important, but you have a core belief, no, I'm not, then you're not going to take it in.
And it really just gets reenacted, right?
Yeah.
It just keeps this story alive that's built on a faulty premise.
Right.
And you're pointing the finger at the other person when in reality, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
Okay.
So that's a good example of, you know, asking the people, you know, how long have you felt unimportant? And usually people will say, well, I've never felt important.
Mm.
And you're also demonstrating to the partner that this is a sensitive issue. And that this is why the person kind of breaks down around not putting the dish in the dishwasher. That's the symbol.
It sounds like two parts, really. The woman in this example has an inside job to do, and hopefully the partner can make a stretch as well.
Right.
Okay.
And then I think, you know, in your example, the woman would need to learn how she kind of sets it up. You know, I mean, she did this for 20 years and all of a sudden now she wants the person to change. And this might be, you know, in midlife.
Right.
So, you know, why did it take you so long to be able to say this?
People don't love to look at their part in things. It's so much easier to point the finger and really not look at what you might have to do with the dynamic.
Right, exactly. And the other thing is that most people, you know, we talk about in healthy love, there's a high level of emotional intimacy. What does that mean? You know, it means I'm feeling bad about something and I want to tell this person, but I'm afraid of their reaction. They might yell at me. They might laugh at me. They might leave me. You know, there's so we over adapt instead of being emotionally honest. I think that's one of the biggest problems in relationships, but they have to feel safe in order to do that. And if there's been a lot of toxicity or negativity, they've got to clean that up, and both people need to be on the same page, if you follow me.
I
they
do.
Want to change, they want to grow, and if they desire it, and they're willing to put in the work, they can change. I believe that.
Earlier, you touched on the word sharing, and I just reread your Power Plays chapter. And you talk a lot about I think there are 20 plus power plays, which I have memorized by now.
Yeah.
You can ask me any. but you also talk about sharing power. Can you give an example of what sharing power looks like?
You know, in power plays, there's always a one up and one down position. Okay. And there's usually a rescuer, persecutor, or victim. If you look at the dynamics of psychological games or people keep switching positions. But in power sharing, there's an equality. You know, it's, there's a sense that, you know, we're emotional and spiritual equals. We may not, you know, one person may be more talented in one area. One might be find parenting easier than the other, but the fundamentals of each person, there is that knowing, you know, we're in this together, we're equal. And you know, they celebrate, instead of jealousy or projection, they celebrate the successes of the other person. You know, even if it's, that was a wonderful dinner, thank you. Mm-hmm. And there's compromising, and there's like I said, there's no one up or one down, and it's accepting people where they're at. It's listening, discussing, suggesting, inviting, rather than telling, bribing, or threatening. That's very different. And there's not the verbal, emotional, physical abuse that is often present. So another one is being assertive, but not passive or aggressive. Mm-hmm. You know, usually when you think of, to me, positive anger is being assertive by saying, stop. You know, the example I give is, if you went outside, you saw someone verbally abusing a child, what would you do? Or if they were physically hitting them, you'd go up and say, stop it. That's not okay. And I think that in a healthy relationship, you're able to be able to say, stop, that doesn't feel good. And the other person will hear you. They say, oh, I guess I wasn't thinking about that. So there's that willingness to listen, willingness for both people to say, you know, we both can work on things here. So anyway, it's important and difficult to power share, but first you have to. I mean, power plays are so common. I think what happens is people get in a rut of negativity. That's what they know. And it's like the Bickersons. They just bicker, mm-hmm. you know. And they almost find comfort in that dynamic. They know it. It's predictable. But at some point, it's going to wear a little thin. And someone's going to say, enough's enough. I'm out of here.
I like that reframing of assertive versus aggressive or passive. And it's interesting because mm-hmm. I notice that sometimes people will say like, oh, I'm so proud of myself. I was assertive. Mm-hmm. When in reality, they were aggressive.
Yeah. Just like I said, love is an energy. Power is an energy. People don't give it to us. You know, you hear people say, well, I'm powerless when I come to him. And, or I feel overpowered. But power is our own life energy, and we all have it. And to be able to own it and to be able to stand up for ourselves. And, you know, we talk a lot about the inner child, which is, we do have one. We do have a child ego state. And it's our responsibility to be able to set those boundaries and protect that inner child and to say, stop, that's not okay. Let's talk about this. So power sharing is, first of all, knowing that you have personal power and you get to decide how to express it.
I remember the example that you use in that chapter where your daughter is a toddler. She's in the kitchen and she's playing with, I don't know, Tupperware or something and making a huge mess. And she's, you know, suddenly shifts gears and she's like, mommy, I want you to read me a book. And an example of power sharing is, well, you were getting frustrated, but instead of going there, you said, well, listen, I have time to do one thing. That is either clean up the mess or read you a book. Which one? So you kind of invited her in to be a part of that decision-making.
Yeah, because, actually, power plays go back to the 2 and 3 year old. part of us, you know, where we had to, we would stop being the center of the universe, is where you have to say, well, now you can think and remember and talk. So you've got to join the grownups and share your power.
Right.
And that's where I think a lot of parenting goes wrong. People, they sort of bribe the child or punish the child. It's not easy.
I'm glad you're bringing it up, because I also sometimes notice a theme of the child overpowering the parents.
Yes.
And so, like, my impression is that the parents aren't guiding that power, that personal potency.
Right. That child will likely grow up in a one-up position if that child is not taught to power share at a young age.
So, Brenda, we talked about some of the themes that are common in long-term relationships, where a communication can break down and how couples might make a stretch and change their communication patterns. What about for those in midlife and beyond that are single at this stage of life? What are some considerations for dating in midlife and beyond?
Well, I think that you have to take a look at why are people single? You know, did they lose a partner through death? Did they lose a partner by choice or by divorce? And or is it they had a long-term career and now they're just deciding whether or not to be in a primary relationship? But I think that most of the people that I worked with are people that have left a relationship or been left. And in that case, I think I see a lot of people just jumping into relationships right away and not taking the time to really know themselves and to be comfortable being alone. And, you know, to learn to enjoy their own company. You know, they talk a lot about loneliness in our society. And I think part of it is people don't know how to be alone, how to enjoy themselves, how to have a full, balanced, rich life. And I think that if people are in between relationships, they really have an opportunity to get to know themselves and what they want in life. And they also can take a look at, okay, how did I contribute to the demise of that relationship? What do I want to do differently? And to be more intentional about going into relationship and really assessing, like, well, what are the absolutes that I need in a relationship? You know, what are the...
I like that. What are the
nice
absolutes?
But not, what are the, they're nice, but not essential kinds of things. And then what are the bottom lines? You know, it's, I will never live with an alcoholic, or you get to choose and to think about how you want to be different. And I think go slow, you know, I mean, really explore. And I think another thing that, people don't do is recognize the red flags that were there, because when people are newly in love, and if we're talking about romantic relationships, you know, all the virtues shine and the best comes out. And that's a good thing. But as life goes on, then all the vices show up. And can you live? I mean, some of the vices are, you know, they leave the toothbrush out every day. You know, you can live with that. but it's an opportunity to really grow individually and to take some time and define the kind of relationship you want.
And it just seems like if letting go by choice was the situation, it'd be such a nice time to really be done with old patterns.
Yes. And I think this is a prime time for people to get some of those healthy puzzle pieces. What does a healthy relationship look like? There's a lot we can learn. We were limited in the information we were given. How many of us got courses on how to love ourselves, how to be a great parent, and how to do healthy relationships. No, if we see things that weren't in a previous relationship, we can talk to someone about why, you know, why did that, you know, and what was my contribution to that?
If a person is single at this stage of life, or, you know, you mentioned a lot of reasons why they might be, but how would you discern if someone is single because they're more relationship avoidant versus single because they genuinely are happy being single? What would those flags be?
There are the anti-dependent, I don't need anybody. Mm-hmm. I think if a person really is comfortable with themselves and they want to be in relationship versus the neediness, because if you were real needy and you didn't get your needs met and you got hurt, you might fear going into a relationship. So I think of fear and kind of an anti-dependent stance are the things that identify you're staying out of a relationship for the wrong reasons.
I see.
And if you're comfortable with yourself and you like your life and you have a rich social life, you have good friends and family, you may choose not to. You may choose to let it be. And if someone shows up, they show up.
You also talked about one of the reasons someone might be single in midlife or beyond is being widowed. And I know at some point we mm-hmm. all come face to face with the reality of loss. I know I'm noticing that more and more as I get older. What's your experience mm-hmm. with clients who are widowed?
You know, there's some research. I haven't checked it out lately, but at one time, they find that women do better long, you know, in that stage than men do. You know, I hate to be sexist here, but men, I think, didn't realize until someone dies that they have emotional needs and feelings. And they usually get into a relationship more quickly than, say, a woman. But I think it's really important to finish the grief and to give it time and to be open to the possibility. And there again, I think they need to be surrounded with really good family and friends and really be comfortable with themselves and not just jump into a relationship because they're lonely.
Even hearing that phrase, they need to finish the grief.
Yes. And that's true in divorce situations too. They're angry and they even remarry or reengage in a primary relationship and they carry that with them.
Mm.
So it's really important to get closure to that.
Are there cases that you see where someone is widowed and they are unable to finish the grief?
Well, I think they might continue to be sad, become depressed, and I think that they may enter another relationship, but they're not fully present. So I think, you know, oftentimes family members will see this, you know, around, you know, their maybe their parent or their sibling, that they're floundering, so to speak. And I think that when people lose a partner, and maybe it's been a really fulfilling relationship, they often feel dead inside, like life is over. And they need to connect with other people who have been through that. I remember my father was like that. My mother died quite young. And he didn't know what emotions were until then. And I was really worried about him. And he was a real strong, competent male. And I gave him a book to read. And, well, he didn't read it. And he was really depressed for a long time. And I remember inviting him over for dinner And he was late and and I was really worried, like, wow, you know, something bad happened to him because he's been really depressed. And he came in and he said, I sat down and read the book you gave me. I never realized other people felt the same way I did. I thought I was the only one, and that that there was something wrong with me, that I was feeling so deeply. And it was like a light bulb went off. And he did remarry. He had a very happy second marriage.
Well, Brenda, thank you for the work you do to guide people to healthier, happier love at all stages of life. But today, more around midlife and beyond. And for teaching us that, you know, love's not this neat little package. It's alive. It needs to be fed, protected, and educated.
Thank you. And it's been my pleasure to be here. And my hope is that people do understand that energy of love, and that we can educate ourselves, that we can learn to be a better partner, a better daughter, son, parent. Love is put into, well, we put it in, or we suppress it. It's up to us.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We'll see you next month.